John chapter 9, and Jesus passed by, verse 1, and he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus answered, said, Neither hath this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God might be made manifest in him. I must work the work of him that sent me while it is day. The night comes when no man can work. Jesus said, As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had spoken thus, he spit on the ground, and he made clay of the spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said unto him, Go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. And he went therefore, and he washed, and he came seeing. Now, in chapter 9, Jesus is believed to be still in the area of the temple in Jerusalem. There's no indication from the text that he's journeyed far away. The text kind of just continues. And he was in Jerusalem, and he was there during the Feast of Tabernacles. It's called the Feast of Booths. And in chapter 9, we're going to see the ground kind of laid, the foundation laid for chapter 10, Jesus the Good Shepherd, how he goes out and seeks his sheep and brings them into his fold. But this is the sixth of the seven miracles. This is miracle number six that Jesus performs in the Gospel of John, that you might believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. Now, we'll outline it as we go through, but verses 1 to 7 are the cure that this man received who was blind from birth. Notice in verse 1, Jesus passed by and he saw a man which was blind from birth. So they're in Jerusalem and he sees a man blind from birth. And at that time it was very common for blindness was a very common thing, and blind people would often have to beg. And so no doubt this man was well known by people in the area. They see him commonly sitting at the spot. They would have their own spot. They're kind of like, that's my turf. This is my begging spot. You know, they didn't have Social Security. They didn't have welfare. They didn't have kind of the government-funded things that we have. So they would just have to beg in many countries of the world today. And it's starting to grow quite prominently here in the United States. We have beggars. Bible says if a man doesn't work, he shouldn't eat. And if a man can work and is able to work, he should work. But there are those cases where people are incapacitated or unable to work. And if we can, the church can take care of them. The government, God has ordained government. Government can take care of them. That's fine. But in those days, they just basically had to stand by the highway or sit by the highway like Bartimaeus and beg that they might have substance to be able to survive. So this man has never seen Jesus, and the Bible tells us that he was blind from his birth. Now, the fact that he was blind from the birth leads the disciples, verse 2, to ask this question. And so the disciples ask him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Isn't it amazing that we often assume when something seemingly bad has happened to somebody, we often assume that they did something wrong. Either this man sinned or his parents sinned. They assume that, what did you do wrong that you are blind? Now, in the Jewish mind, in the culture at that time, they always saw a direct correlation to physical suffering to sin. If you sin, you are afflicted physically. And if you are afflicted physically, then they trace it back to evidence that you have sinned. Remember Job, when he was going through his great plight and suffering, that his three friends showed up and they said, Okay, fess up, Job, what did you do? What's going on here? It's evident that you've done something wrong, or you would not be sick or afflicted in this manner. And Job, before God, knew that he hadn't done anything wrong. The Bible tells us that Job was an upright man and a godly man, and he loved God, loved his family. As a matter of fact, God was bragging about Job to the devil when he was there in heaven, and Job had done nothing wrong. So let's not assume that some tragedy in somebody's life is a direct relationship to something that they have done wrong. In a bigger sense, and this is looking at the world with a Christian worldview, sin and suffering, sin has brought suffering into the world. When someone has disease, we see death, we see tragedy, we see sorrow. In a big sense, it has come into the world through man's sin. But to individually say, oh, you know, the reason why that you've got that cancer is because you've sinned somewhere. God is punishing you. That's just not true. Now, an interesting thing, too, is that the man was born blind. And the disciples ask, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? How do you sin if you're born blind and have it the result of your sin? The Jews, interestingly, actually believed in prenatal sins. They actually believed that you could sin in the womb. What would constitute sin in the womb? I do not know. You know, kicking and flailing through the night so your mother can't sleep or something? I don't know. A little sinner, you know, he's going off in my womb and God's going to punish him for this. But they believed in prenatal sins, and those says, oh, you know, his parents have sinned or he has sinned. And be careful today. There's a real, I think, unbiblical teaching today which emphasizes the sins of the parents and the idea of inheriting problems because your parents sinned or your grandparents sinned. And it's a dangerous doctrine that you need to be careful of. So Jesus says in answer to their question, it's quite insightful, neither hath this man sinned nor his parents. Now, I believe you need to, in thought process, stop right there. Jesus, at this point, is answering their question. What is the answer to their question? Neither one. Neither has this man sinned, nor his parents sinned. That's the end of the matter. That's the answer to the question. Then Jesus goes on to say, but that the work of God, or works of God, should be made manifest in him, I must work the works of him that sent me. While it is day, the night comes when no man can work. Now here's another mistake that some people make with this story and leads to confusion. I want to try to clarify this. Jesus, at the end of verse 3, is not saying the man was born blind in order that he might work the works of God. That's not what Jesus is saying. But if you just, in a cursory reading, read that text, you might conclude falsely that God had this man born blind so that at this point in time, when Jesus came along, that Jesus could heal the man and manifest his glory. Now, if God chose to do that, then God can do that. I'm not going to argue with God. God is sovereign and he made all things and he sits on the throne, and by right of creation, God can do whatever he wants, within whatever he wants, whenever he wants. He's God. But God doesn't capriciously afflict people in this way. So we need to be careful that we don't read too much into suffering and tragedy in people's lives and falsely conclude that, you know, God is punishing them, or that God just, you know, maybe created them that way and then now God's going to, you know, do something. But, you know, we try to second guess God. I learned the longer I walk with God, the more I realize I don't understand the ways of the Lord. I don't understand why God does what he does. I don't want to put God in a little box and have him all figured out. You know, why the man was blind, we don't know. But Jesus is saying, neither did his parents sin or he, but right now, right here before us is a need. And in light of this need, I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night comes when no man can work. So what he means by that in verse 4 is that this is the opportunity. This is the daytime. This is the time we can work. There's coming a time when, and he's speaking kind of metaphorically here, the night will come, my ministry will be over, the opportunities will not be here. And he likens it unto the nighttime. We've got to serve God while it is day. Now, the same principle applies to all of our lives. And I must confess that I lose sight of this. And it's easy to forget about this fact that God has given us opportunities, and they are now, and we must seize them. I realize there's a time to wait on the Lord, and that God will use us when He wants, where He wants, how He wants. But on the other hand, we so often waste days, weeks, months, and years not seizing opportunities to serve the Lord, to minister to others, to invest in the things of the kingdom, and to just really do our best to be used by God in the time that we have. And none of us have any idea how long we have. You might say, well, I'm in my 50s and I've got another 20 years. You know, I find myself doing that kind of thing. You know, wow, I got less ministry in front of me than I now have had behind me. And, you know, I need to get busy and do what I can do. But you never know. The Lord may come for you tonight. The Lord may come for you tomorrow. The Lord may come for you next Saturday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't know. You never know. 16 years old, driving down the freeway, slide off the freeway, and you're in eternity. You think you have your whole life ahead of you. And you just never know. Now that you have breath, now that you're alive, now that you're here, as the Scriptures say in Ecclesiastes, remember thy Creator in the days of thy youth. Serve the Lord. Live for the Lord. Store up treasures in heaven, not on earth. Jesus said Himself, I only have so much time. I must, verse 4, work the works of Him that sent me while it is day. The night comes when no one can work, and the night will come for every one of us individually, when we can no longer work. So let's get busy serving the Lord and doing what God has called us to do. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. So here we have this miracle pointing to Jesus, the light of the world. This blind man is going to receive sight. So after the little dialogue with the disciples clearing up this issue, when he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of the, King Jimmy has spattle, I like that. So he spit on the ground and he kind of mixed it around, made some mud. And it tells us there that he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. I've often said it's a good thing he was blind, didn't know what was going on. Gee, Lord, that feels kind of gooey. What is that, you know? And don't ask questions, just go wash in the pool of Siloam, you know? But, you know, this is very interesting. We do not know for sure what Jesus had in mind when he used the clay. Some say the Jews considered that spat or spit had medicinal value, that it would, you know, bring healing or something. I don't know. But Jesus healed in different ways at different times. There was another time there was the deaf man came and Jesus actually stuck his fingers in his ear. And he sighed. He actually spit, sighed, and stuck his fingers in his ear. And then, you know, spoke healing to this man. And then sometimes he would just speak the word, or he would lay hands on the eye. So there are different ways Jesus would heal at different times. So again, we can't pattern ourselves after that or put God in any box or anything. God is a God of infinite variety, and He has different ways to do different works. I'm guessing there was some kind of significance behind this clay, and some feel that it was purposely placed in the man's eyes to create an irritant to facilitate the man's obedience in faith to go wash it off. Had Jesus not had any physical contact with this blind man, he can't see him. He didn't know anything was going on. And Jesus could have just spoke the words, but he wanted a response of faith in this blind man, it would seem. So in instructing the man to go to the pool of Siloam and wash off the clay, the man had to do that in act of obedience. And in doing that, the man experienced this healing. So it could be that Jesus was trying to draw out his faith and give him an opportunity to respond in faith, to go down to the pool and to wash out the mud. And so the man went, verse 7, he said unto him, go and wash in the pool of Siloam, which is my interpretation. And he went his way, therefore, and washed, and he came seeing. So just the fact. Now, I've been to the pool of Siloam. It's a very, very cool little kind of in the southeast corner of Jerusalem, and it's right in these little houses. And it enters in Jerusalem out of what is called the old Hezekiah's tunnel. And outside the city of Jerusalem, there's what's called the Gihon Spring. And from the spring, about 1,500 feet underground, comes this little tunnel. And then this pool comes into this area. There's stairs going down. And it exists to this day. You can go to Jerusalem and see the Pool of Siloam where Jesus sent this blind man. And it was also used for the rituals during the Feast of Tabernacles. They would get the water in the buckets to bring back to the temple, and they would pour it out, symbolizing that God had provided water for them when they were in their wilderness wanderings. So, go to the pool, wash, and he did do what Jesus instructed him to do, and praise God, there was a miracle the man was seeing. Now, at this point in the story, and we need to move along, the man had never seen Jesus. He was blind. All he had was hearing. You know, some people who are blind have a heightened sense of hearing. But he had his hearing and a sense of smell and other ways to kind of tell what was going on. But he hadn't seen Jesus, and he perhaps didn't know a whole lot about him. So some guy comes up, puts mud in my eyes, I don't even know who it is, and tells me to go wash it off. It could be that knowing it was mud, he gladly went to wash it off. But the man came seeing. And can you imagine what joy must have filled his heart? And he's thinking, this is incredible. Who is this guy? And as you go through the story, you're going to see a progression of how his understanding of who Jesus is grew until it climaxed when he came to know Jesus was Lord, and I believe received his spiritual sight, as well as at this point his physical sight. At this point, that's all he has. So now we move from the cure to the controversy, verses 8 to 34. And first we see the reaction of the neighbors in verses 8 to 12. And it's a great story, and I just kind of love the humor involved in it. It's just so such a wonderful story. The neighbors, therefore, and they which before had seen him that was blind, said, is not this he that sat and begged? So indeed there's the reference to him sitting and begging. They knew who it was. And they just said, is this the blind beggar? And some said, he is he. And others said, he is like him. But he said, I am he. I like that. I see these people standing around. The guy's beaming, and he's looking at him, and they're all like puzzled. And is that the blind beggar? No, looks like him. Is this really him? And he goes, I'm him. It's me. I love it in the King James. I am he. And it's just this kind of debate going on as to, is this that blind man? They just were amazed. You know, when the Lord touches a person's life, he so radically changes them often that people can hardly even recognize that they're a new person. Therefore said they unto him, how, verse 10, were thine eyes opened? And he answered and said, a man that is called Jesus made clay, anointed mine eyes, and said unto me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And I went and washed, and I received my sight. Pretty simple, huh? I mean, all he does is lay down the facts. How were your eyes open? Well, all I know is the guy's name is Jesus. He put some mud in my eyes, told me to go to the pool of Siloam and wash, and I went, and now I see. Just the facts. He was blind, he is the man, and now he sees. Then said they unto him, where is he? Referring to Christ. And he said, I don't know. Now we have in verses 13 to 17, the Pharisees are brought in, because we're going to find out in verse 14, kind of da-da-da-da, this miracle happened on the Sabbath day, wouldn't you know it? Couldn't happen on Sunday. Could happen on Monday. No, why didn't it happen on Thursday? Everything would be cool, but it had to happen on Saturday. Man, they get really uptight. You're not supposed to heal people on the Saturday, on the Sabbath. And so they brought him to the Pharisees. They brought the Pharisees unto him, that aforetime was blind. And it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the clay and anointed his eyes. Then again, the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight, and he said unto them, he put clay upon mine eyes, I washed, and I do see. I like this guy. He doesn't mess around. He just kind of just gets right down to it, you know. Therefore said some of the Pharisees, this man is not of God because he doesn't keep the Sabbath day. Others said, how can a man that is a sinner do such miracles? And notice there was a division among them. Jesus is always causing division in that people either believe him or they reject him. They're either for him or they're against him. Jesus said, think not that I come to bring peace, I come to bring a sword. And many times a man's enemies will be those of his very own household. You become a believer in Jesus Christ, and people around you may not be happy about that. And then they said unto the blind man, verse 17 again, what sayest thou of him? That he hath opened thine eyes. And he said, I think he's a prophet. Now earlier you said, oh, he's just a man. He's a man named Jesus. Now the second stage of his growing understanding of who Jesus was is that perhaps this guy is a prophet. Now in verses 18 to 23, they call his parents, and this is classic, the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been born blind. They say, ah, this guy wasn't even blind. You know, it wasn't a real miracle. The dude was never blind. I don't know if he was faking it or what. Now, there are people who fake miracles. That is an abomination. And that's wrong. And they'll have to answer to God for that something. There's fake word of knowledge and insight, you know, and they gather information from people and they have a little radio in their ear, you know, and all the different things that have gone on in the name of, God. And it's tragic. So they think, you were probably never really blind. You're just one of those phony balonies. And you didn't really receive your sight. So they called the parents of him that had received his sight. In verse 19, they asked them, saying, is this your son whom you say was born blind? How then does he now see? And his parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son. Well, that's nice. And that he was born blind, fact number two that we're aware of. But by what means now he sees, we do not know. Or who hath opened his eyes, we know not. He's of age. Ask him. He shall speak for himself. Why are you bugging us? You pulled us away from a good television show we're right in the middle of, you know. What's going on? I mean, yes, that's our son. Yes, he was born blind. How he can see, I don't know. He's old enough. Ask him. Now, you'll see in this text that their real concern was if anyone testified that Jesus was the Messiah, they were going to be excommunicated from the synagogue, and they didn't want that to happen. Now, what they said would be acceptable in a court of law, but they were kind of fudging a bit because they didn't want to be excommunicated from the synagogue. These words spake his parents, verse 22, because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was the Messiah, that he should be put out of the synagogue. Proverbs 29, verse 25, the fear of man brings a snare. Therefore said his parents, he is of age, ask him. So that episode's over. So now they go back to the blind man. You see, these Pharisees were religious, but they were blind. Isn't it tragic that these guys were to be the spiritual leaders, and instead of rejoicing that a blind man has been healed, and believing that Jesus is their Messiah in their midst, they're all critical and fault-finding and you know, this censorious, critical, judgmental attitude and trying to get to the bottom of it. You know, we have this rule that you can't really heal on the Sabbath day. Man, you can't be of God. You know, you're working on the religion brings you into bondage and you become legalistic. And you forget about people and their needs and the love of God and the mercy of God and the grace of God. All you care about is all your petty little man-made rules and traditions. And you don't really care about people in need. Rather than rejoicing, oh, this is awesome. Praise be to God. A blind man can see. And oh, what an awesome thing this is. And rejoicing instead, wait a minute, that was on the Sabbath. You can't do that. And then you aren't really blind, you know. And they just, and it just continues. They get more cynical and angry. Finally, they just say, oh, you were altogether born in sin. And they kicked him out of the synagogue. They just get all emotional and just, you know, freak out on the guy. And there you go. These are their so-called spiritual leaders, the religious leaders of the day. So again, they called the man that was blind, verse 24, and they said unto him, give God praise. We know that this man is a sinner. In other words, give the glory to God. Don't give any credit to this man. This man worked on the Sabbath day, and we know that this man is a sinner. Now, some feel that that phrase, give God the praise, is kind of a phrase by which they would use to implore people to tell the truth. And it could be that that's what they're saying, but it seems to be more that they're just saying, look, you know, don't give this Jesus fellow the credit. Give God the credit, but, you know, don't give this man the credit, which is kind of silly. If God did it, he used this instrument, it should have given God praise, period, anyway. But he answered and said unto them, whosoever, whether he be a sinner or not, I know not. But I know one thing, that whereas I was blind, and now I see. You guys want to debate? You guys want to talk about whether he's of God or he's a sinner or whatever? All I know is I was blind and now I can see, okay? We just leave you alone. It's like, all right already, you know what? Cool it, man. I mean, all I know is that I sat at that spot begging for years, and I've been blind since I was born, and now I can see. And you want to quibble over whether this man was of God or not. You know, in a way, this is kind of a great illustration of our testimony, isn't it? When Jesus changes your life and people argue with you. You just psych yourself into believing there's a God. I know you used to drink and smoke and cuss and steal and run around. And I know your life has changed. But you know what? It's just because you finally matured. You kind of reached an age where you realize that, you know, you had to get your act together and straighten out your life. And there's really no God. And it wasn't Jesus that did this. You really weren't born again. And, you know, you just kind of psyched yourself into it or freaked out. You know, and they people have some of the craziest ideas about conversion experiences. And they can argue with you all they want. But what is your answer? All I know is that once I was blind, and now I see. You can give me your theories on evolution and that there is no God and why the Bible's not the Word of God and why Jesus isn't the Son of God. And all that stuff, but all I know is that once I was blind and now I see. God has changed my life. If anybody knows it, I do. I had a front row seat. I was right there. I saw God change my attitude, my actions, my speech, my desires. God has changed my life. Anyone see Billy Graham on TV last night? Again, there was the TV Billy Graham special. And they focused on that prison again. I should write this down. I've seen it now twice. It just is awesome. I believe the prison is North Carolina or Louisiana or some of the, you know, once you get out of California, I don't know where you're at. Fact or something, there's a prison. It was statistically the bloodiest, most violent prison in the United States. Horrendous, just prisoner against prisoner crime going on and so forth. And several years ago, prisoners began to pray, and there was a chaplain, and began to pray for revival, and God began to save men, and they brought in a full-time chaplain, and the warden, the head warden, is a Christian, loves Jesus, and they built a church inside the prison, and like 95% of these prisoners were born again. And they're all just praising the Lord and hugging each other and studying the Bible. They have a seminary inside this prison. And these guys are being trained to preach and taught theology. And when they get out, they're going out and starting churches. And God's just blowing their minds and doing this. It's just this miracle of all miracles. And every time I see the info on this place, it just blows my mind. I got to go back and visit it someday. Spend a few days in prison with these guys. It's so cool. No violence, no crimes. Just changed men by the power of God. God doing a mighty work. And all they say is, all I know is once I was blind and now I can see. And if you get saved and God begins to change you, you don't need to be a theologian to tell someone this. You don't have to know Greek or Hebrew. You don't have to have been a Christian for years, have to be an evangelist. All you need to say, I was blind and now I see. His name was Jesus and He's changed my life. That's your testimony. And you can tell anyone, and we ought to tell everyone. You ought to tell everybody what God has done for you. And where the rubber meets the road is just sharing with them what God has done in your life. And they can argue with that all that they want. But the facts are there. My life has been changed. And it's been changed by the power of God. So I love this as a picture of the simple testimony. I was blind, but now I see. Then said they unto him again, well, what did he do to you? They're really mad. How did he open your eyes? He answered them. And now the man begins to get a little sarcastic with them. I told you already. You didn't hear. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to be his disciples? Oh, that really infuriated them. You guys want to follow? And they reviled him and said, thou art his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. Oh, groovy doovy. It's not in the Bible. I just threw that in there. We know that God spake unto Moses as far as this fellow. We know not whence from whence he is. The man answered and said unto them, why? Herein is a marvelous thing that you know not from whence he is, and yet he hath opened mine eyes. Now, the blind man has more insight and understanding in spiritual things than these religious leaders. He's drawing here from Psalm 66:18. Now we know that God hears not sinners, but if any man be a worshiper of God and doth his will, him he heareth. Since the world began, was it not heard that a man opened the eyes of a man that is born blind? If this man were not of God, he could do nothing. And they answered and said unto him, you were altogether born in sins, and you're trying to teach us? And they kicked him out, cast him out. You know, when you can't logic, when you can't deal with somebody logically, you just get emotional, scream and yell, and kick him out, right? That's the thing to do. Don't confuse me with the facts. My mind is made up. Get emotional, get angry, and just say, just kick him out of the temple. Now, I love this guy. In Psalm 66:18, the psalmist says there, if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me. Regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear. That means that you purposely, intentionally allow sin in your life, that it severs your connection with God. Now, God is omniscient. He knows all things. So it's not in that sense that God cannot actually hear you. God knows, He hears, He understands all things. But God will not respond to you. God is not obligated to answer your prayers. You have purposely, intentionally regarded iniquity in your heart, and the Lord will not hear you. That is by a point I would make, one of the ways that we have unanswered prayer. Unanswered prayer is when we allow sin to come into our life. If I regard iniquity in my heart, God will not hear me. So if you are regarding iniquity in your heart and you're wondering why God isn't answering your prayers, there's your answer. You need to confess your sin and forsake your sin. And God may hear your prayers and answer your prayers. God will hear your prayers and answer your prayers. This guy says, you know, since the world began, it's never been said that a man would open the eyes of the blind. If he were not of God, he could do nothing. So he makes some real sense here. It seems to have some real reason, and they can't reason with him any longer. And they just said, you were altogether born in sin. You're trying to teach us. These men are proud, self-righteous, and blind. We're going to see that in closing. How tragic it is. These men are so blind to the truth. May God help us and save us. This kind of prejudice and blindness. Now we have in closing the man's confession. Verse 35 down to verse 41. So Jesus heard that the man had been cast out. This is beautiful. And when he found him, now the word found him indicates that Jesus actually sought him out. In chapter 10, Jesus is going to be the good shepherd, and this is laying the foundation for that. Seeks the sheep. He said unto him, do you believe on the Son of God? The man answered and said, who is he, Lord, that I might believe on him? Now remember, he didn't see Jesus when he was healed. He was blind. So he is actually seeing Jesus for the first time. And it could be at the beginning of this dialogue, the man didn't even know that he is the one who healed him of his sight. It is just kind of in conversation, it all kind of comes together. Jesus seeks him out. As Jesus seeks us out and saves us and opens our eyes, right? Jesus said, you have not chosen me, but I've chosen you. And that God seeks us and finds us. And I love the man's simple but heartfelt reply. He says to him, who is he, Lord, that I might believe on him? And Jesus said unto him, thou hast both seen him, and it is he that talks with thee. So Jesus says, do you believe on the Son of God? And he says, I want to. Who is he? He calls him Kurios. We saw that word this morning in Philippians 2. Lord, that I might believe on him. And Jesus said, you're looking at him. You're speaking with him. And so he said, Lord, I believe. Now, this is not kurios in just the kind of sir title of respect, but this is Lord in the sense of you are Adonai or Jehovah or Yahweh. I believe. And he worshiped him. Notice he worshiped him because he understood that Jesus was God. And so now he receives his spiritual sight. And Jesus said, for judgment I am come into this world, they which see not might see, and they which see might be made blind. Interesting. I have come like a light into the world to manifest man's true condition. Those that are spiritually blind and they recognize their spiritual blindness and they have a hunger for God and a need for God, their eyes are open. They receive the truth. And then those who are blind, but they don't know they're blind. They think they see. They're proud and self-righteous. When I come into the world, the light that they receive, they reject, and thus a greater blindness comes upon them. It is so very important to respond to the light that we are given. Respond to the light that God gives you and more light will come. Reject the light that God gives you and less light will come. That's why as people get older and they continue to reject the conviction of the Holy Spirit and the witness of other believers, the opportunities to get saved, they get harder and harder and harder and harder in their sin. Till in a sense, they're almost a state of spiritual atrophy. They just cannot believe. It's very important that if God is speaking to you and God has revealed Himself to you, that you respond positively to that revelation that God brings to you. Now, I'm thinking in terms of the church of Laodicea in Revelation chapter 3, verses 14 to 20, where they thought they had sight, they had riches, but God says, you're miserable, poor, wretched, naked, and blind, and you need to buy from me true riches, and you need to buy from me a garment that your nakedness might be covered, and you need to buy this eye salve to anoint your eyes that you might see. So there are those that think they see, but in reality they are blind. And some of the Pharisees, verse 40, which were with him, heard these words, and they said unto him, are we blind also? And Jesus said unto them, and I can almost, if I were there, I'm thinking, you asked for it. He kept quiet. Jesus said unto them, if you were blind, you should have no sin. But now you say that you see, therefore your sin remains. If you were truly, truly humble and admitted your true condition, and they were dead in sins, they were born in sin, no different than the blind man, then they could see. But now they think they see, they are self-righteous. And therefore, their sin remains. In other words, light brings responsibility. And because they did not turn to Christ and believe in Him, their sin remains. They were not forgiven. They are unrepentant. And they would not turn to the Lord. They heard, they saw, they had the best. This man born blind, he's right in front of you. The evidence is there. But their hearts were hardened. They would not believe. What a sad thing that is. We need to pray for our loved ones and family members and friends that don't know Jesus. We need to testify as God gives us opportunity. Share your testimony. Share the truth that can set them free. Now, the fact that Jesus sought this man out, in closing, is leading us right into chapter 10, where we see that Jesus is the good shepherd. And that Jesus, in that sense, will seek out and find his sheep. And this man was cast out of the temple, and most Bible scholars believe that it was a formal, official excommunication. It wasn't just, okay, the meeting's over, you can go now. He was excommunicated. And for a Jew, that was tragic. They would be cut off from all the social interaction, all their spiritual life and all their Jewish rituals and holidays. They'd be cut off from all that. You're excommunicated. And the scriptures seem to support that that was official excommunication and that Jesus, for that reason, sought this man out. A little drama here that to me it touches the strings of the heart to think that Jesus cared enough about that man. He knew that what he was going to go through would be traumatic and difficult, and he sought him out and he revealed himself to this man. Rather than this man just being ostracized by the Jews and left alone, Jesus said, come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, I'll give you rest. You've been kicked out of of Judaism, but come into my fold. Follow me. I am the Messiah. I'm the Savior. I'm the light of the world. I'm the good shepherd. He reached out to this man and brought him in. What a beautiful picture that is, and what God has done for us as well. Once I was blind, but now I see. Amen. Let's pray.